13 relating to retail transactions. The bill requires that certain stores require identification of individuals from whose store purchased used goods, require a store to keep specified information about each purchase of used goods, make failure to require identification to keep records subject to maximum fine of $300.
All right. Senator Walker.
Mr. Chair, I move introduction of LC 1913.
Senator Walker moves introduction of LC 1913. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. Thank you very much. And I've been given my instructions by the Democratic leader of the Senate, who's apparently an esteemed member of this august body of individuals we're going to speak to us today. Dave Kanegi, are you speaking first? Did I get that right? David Max, and then Wendy Johnson. We all come up together. Thank you very much. And I have a tendency to speak softly, so if you don't hear me, please admonish me. I'll try to raise my voice. Speak up, okay. I'm getting the admonishment already. The risk of sounding like I'm yelling. All right. Go ahead, sir.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Representative Max Williams, and I'm appearing before you today as a member of the Oregon Law Commission. We appreciate the opportunity to present bills which the commission has worked on over the last interim, and you'll hear some of those presented to you today in more detail by the individuals who've worked on the work group. On my right is Dave Kanegi, who is the Executive Director of the Oregon Law Commission and an Associate Dean at Willamette University College of Law, and on my left is Wendy Johnson, who is the Assistant Executive Director for the Oregon Law Commission. As most of you probably recall, the Law Commission was formed by the Legislative Assembly in 1997 with the purpose primarily to deal with law improvement issues. It is in part housed through the relationship that the Law Commission has with the Office of Legislative Counsel. And in 2000, July, it entered into a public-private partnership for the operation of the Law Commission with the Willamette University College of Law. That is a situation where the university matches the funds put forward by the legislature through the Office of the Legislative Counsel to run the operations of the commission. The commission is made up of 13 members, which includes four legislators or their designees, two Senate appointees, and two House appointees, the Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court, the Attorney General, an appointee by the governor, the deans or representatives of the deans from each of Oregon's three law schools, and three representatives from the Oregon State Bar that are appointed by the Oregon Board of Bar Governors from the bar. In addition to the 13 commissioners, there are over 200 volunteers, largely lawyers and judges, but a number of non-lawyer and judge types as well from particular industries, lobbyists and the like, who serve on the Law Commission's law reform work groups. The way the work group process works is as people bring law reform ideas forward to the commission, there is a program committee that makes a determination as to whether or not the subject would be presented to the full law commission for review, and then a work group is appointed. There are a number of operating work groups. In this 2001-2002 interim, eight work groups have advanced various recommendations to the Oregon legislature, which will be under consideration in both the House and the Senate as this process begins. Later today, you'll hear from one of the most active work groups that was addressing a number of juvenile code revisions through a very lengthy process. And I'll just take a moment here, I guess, to point out that I view, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, often the work of the Law Commission as the work that, if they weren't doing it, there might not be anyone else interested enough in the issues to do it. And a prime example is a work group that I've chaired for almost the last 4 years dealing with revision to the judgment and garnishment sections of Oregon statute. There just frankly isn't an interest group out there with lobbying power to get bills initiated, but there are a number of practitioners, judges, and the like who have recognized over the years the significant need for law improvement in those areas of the Oregon statutes, and the law commission often does the work that frankly nobody else would want to do to improve our statutory system in this state and to advance law improvement generally. So that is the purpose of the commission. That is the work of the commission. It is important work, particularly for all of those individuals, citizens of Oregon and the like, who have to rely on Oregon statutes and Oregon laws in the conducting of their business and the conducting of their personal lives, from everything you hear today, from juvenile law to the operations of their businesses to how garnishments work, and that broad spectrum, frankly, that advances the benefits of a revised and functioning statutory system in Oregon. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'm going to turn a couple of seconds over to Dave Kanagi to talk about the reports that the Law Commission will be presenting along with the legislation that it will present to the committee.
All right, Representative, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Kanagi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dave Kanagi. I'm Associate Dean at the Willamette University College of Law and serve also in a part-time capacity as Executive Director of the Oregon Law Commission. I have just one thing I wish to add to the comments of Representative Williams before we get started today, and it has to do with the way in which the Law Commission performs its law revision, reform, improvement work. Each of you would have received, because I delivered them myself, copies of various reports which accompany each of the bills you will be hearing about today. These reports, which are also made available today and will be a part of the handout, are essential to the work of the Commission because, in the view of the Oregon Law Commission, it's essential that we show what we are doing, why we're doing it, and create a level of transparency about the work of the Commission to answer questions later about, now, what was it exactly they were trying to do? The simplest story I can share to demonstrate the wisdom that we think of what we do with each of these bills and the discipline we engage in preparing these reports, which are a lot of additional work to be sure, is this. When I had my first son hit junior high, I'll never forget the day he came home from a math class and had the right answer but no credit because he didn't show his work. And when that reality hit home in our household, things changed. And we realize the importance of showing your work. And as you'll see today, both in the form of these reports and from the people who Senator Brown will be introducing and presenting to you in terms of the work of the Juvenile Code Revision Work Group, the Law Commission has worked hard to show its work. And that is what is embodied in these reports, which we're proud to bring to you along with the bills themselves. Now, what makes these reports happen is, again, the efforts of our volunteers, but I cannot go any further without introducing our Assistant Executive Director, Wendy Johnson, who has been the editor-in-chief, if you will, of an enormous amount of effort, all of which you will see collected in our biennial report, which will be distributed and made available this Thursday. And I wanted Wendy to just take a moment to discuss something even further beyond the reports, which relates to the way in which we track our specific work group meetings, again, to leave footprints of our work and transparency in the lawmaking process, which we think validates, supports, and strengthens the quality of lawmaking here in Oregon for all Oregonians. Wendy Johnson.
Wendy, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would just like to introduce our Juvenile Code Work Group, which, as Representative Williams has explained, is one of our most active work groups. This work group generally meets monthly for 3 hours or 4 hours and works on the various juvenile issues that are a problematic in the ORS today. The reports that you do have in front of you are the culmination of their process for each bill. We do provide a summary meeting report for each monthly meeting that tracks the progress and the issues that the work group is still debating. The attorneys that will be presenting today are just a small representation of this group, which is over 50 members strong, judges and lawyers, members of agencies, private attorneys, people that are just interested in the juvenile laws and procedures of this state. I just want to thank each of those members today, and just want to make sure that you understand the work that has gone into each one of these bills.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you
for your
testimony.
All right. And Senator Kate Brown.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is State Senator Kate Brown, and I've had the pleasure of chairing the Juvenile Code rewrite for a number of years at this point in time. As Wendy noted, we have a number of lawyers, judges, agency folks working on this work group. We have met on a monthly basis, I think with a few breaks for Thanksgiving and some other holidays. These folks have put in hundreds of hours of volunteer time in doing these proposals. Some of the projects that we worked on during the interim included technical fix-ups to House Bill 2611, which I'll be talking about shortly, creation of a juvenile court guardianship, I confess, a failed rewrite of the juvenile delinquency procedures, and hopefully you'll be seeing a creation of the juvenile PSRB, which will not come under the auspices of the Oregon Law Commission. The bills you have in front of you this morning include Senate Bill 67. To my left, Timothy Travis will be talking about that bill. I will be talking about Senate Bill 68, which means that it's a very simple bill because only a simple-minded soul can explain it, and Senate Bill 70, Lisa Kay, Senate Bill 71, Lisa Kay, and Senate Bill 72, Lisa Kay. And with that, Mr. Chair, could we move into a public hearing on Senate Bill 68?
To redeem the time, we will. Public hearing.
Thank you. Colleagues, for the record, my name is State Senator Kate Brown. I would like to introduce you Senate Bill 68, which is, frankly, a housekeeping measure. Last session, you may recall, we passed House Bill 2611, which was a rewrite of the Juvenile Dependency Code. We deal with children who are abused or neglected. The goal of House Bill 2611 was to make sure that the Juvenile Dependency Code was consistent, was uniform, and most importantly, user-friendly. For those of us who have practiced or are practicing in juvenile court, you will understand and you see a lot of individuals who do not have attorneys, and we wanted to make sure that the code was written in such a way that anyone, grandparent, aunt, cousin, could pick up the code and hopefully understand what happened and what was going on in the juvenile court process. Senate Bill 68 is a fix-up. Last session, we created a new section codified at ORS 419.116, setting forth the standards for allowing intervention in juvenile court proceedings. Subsection 8 of that statute referred to three repealed statutory reference. This bill simply puts in the correct statutory reference, which is ORS 419B.923. It now governs modification of juvenile court orders and judgments and should be substituted for .420, .423, and .426. The second thing this bill does is replace, again, another repealed statutory reference. Under House Bill 2611, we created ORS 419B.389, and the specific statutory reference referred to there is ORS 419B.420, which allows a parent who's unable to comply with the support order of the court to seek relief if they have financial, health, or other problems. 420 was repealed, and again, 419B.923 contains the appropriate statutory reference and should be substituted for 419B.420. I would be happy to answer any questions if I haven't confused you enough already.
Actually, you've done quite well. Were these repealed in House Bill 2611 or in other?
Pardon?
Were they repealed in House Bill 2611 or other?
It was all repealed under House Bill 2611, which is the rewrite.
All right. Great.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, if I may, I've got reports for you on Senate Bill 68.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your time. Tim, do you have other testimony with respect to this bill?
Not on this bill, Senator, on the next bill.
All right. Work session, Senate Bill 68. Senator Walker.
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 68 to the floor with a few fast recommendations on the consent calendar.
Okay, Senator Walker moves Senate Bill 68 to be moved to the Senate floor with a few fast recommendations and added to the consent calendar. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. And Senator.
We already have
this. You kind of got stuck with a heavy one the other day. This was a light one. We'll have you be the official carrier. And
that would be fine.
This bill. Thank you very much. And if we can, is it Senate Bill 67?
Sorry.
Public hearing on Senate Bill 67.
Good morning. I'm Timothy Travis. I'm the Court Improvement Manager for the Oregon Judicial Department, and I'm here as a member of the Juvenile Code Work Group of the Oregon Law Commission. And I'm here today to talk about Senate Bill 67, which is another technical fix, if you will. This fixes a mistake that was made in the last session of the legislature. The telephone testimony statute, ORS 45.400, which is in front of you in Senate Bill 67, was amended in what I understand was an overhaul of the jury trial statutes by people who are not here today. I don't even know for sure who it was. But when the session was over, I got a call from a judge in Bend who said, "What did you do?" Because usually when there's a problem, it's my fault. What happened was, if you look at line 7 of the bill, that used to read, electronic communication device in any civil proceeding, comma, dependency action, comma, or termination of parental rights action, period. That's what it said before last session. Well, you notice it says civil proceeding or. When someone had this statute open last session, they said, oh, dependency proceeding, termination proceeding, those are both civil proceedings. Therefore, to say civil proceeding, dependency action, and termination is redundant. Let's remove this redundancy, put a period after civil proceeding, and we will have cleaned up the statute. This is a classic example of people not quite understanding what they're doing, because a dependency action and a termination action are not civil proceedings. They are what's called sui generis. They are a third category, civil proceeding, criminal proceeding, and sui generis. So as a result, an argument was created that it was no longer possible to have telephone testimony in a juvenile action or in a dependency action or in a termination action. So the judges and the lawyers who work in this area have sort of cobbled together a solution that an argument to keep telephone testimony alive in these actions until we could get back here this very morning and get the ball rolling on putting the language back into the statute so that we have it clear that telephone testimony is okay in these actions. Now, you notice we have not put the exact language back in, because any proceeding under ORS Chapter 419B could be a juvenile court guardianship, it could be a permanent guardianship. So this is better than what it said before, because before it said dependency action and termination action, which arguably could have been limited to the jurisdictional trial and the termination action. That is probably far more than you needed to know about this, but I would conclude by saying good bill should pass. If you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Senator Riggle.
Thank you. It had been the case for a long time that dependency proceedings and termination proceedings could take telephone testimony?
Absolutely, Senator, it was.
And the practitioners on all sides of that issue think that's okay?
Yes, they do.
Okay. I mean, just for purposes of discussion, I know in civil lawsuits, I mean, everybody doesn't think it's okay that it is important to have somebody in the courtroom and evaluating their credibility and handling documents, I wonder why. And you know, it's not allowed in the criminal context, I think, because of additional concerns for the truthfulness of the testimony.
What this provision allows is for a party to make a motion,
right,
to allow for telephone testimony. And if a party has concerns about telephone testimony, they want the witness there to assess their credibility or whatever, then they can argue against this motion being granted, and a judge makes a decision about whether or not it's appropriate to have the telephone testimony.
Right.
It's not a foregone conclusion.
Yeah, I understand, but in criminal cases, they can't even make that motion, just because I assume the rationale is the importance of establishing credibility is even more important when somebody might be thrown in jail for life.
I presume that's true, Senator, yes.
Okay. But that same rationale doesn't apply on termination proceedings or dependency proceedings?
It never has.
Okay.
And as I say, the judge has the discretion to say, no, I want these witnesses to appear in person.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Senator Wong.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Following up on Senator Ringo's comments, part of the goal here, Mr. Travis, is to reduce costs because you get expert testimony and they have to travel and they charge a lot of money per hour. Is that correct?
That is correct, Senator.
Yeah. Well, we use telephone testimony in federal court as well, but we also require all the parties to agree because it is difficult to assess an expert's demeanor when they're on the telephone. It's difficult for court reporters, but I realize the value in it as long as the court still has the option to say yes or no. So that's just a comment.
Just following up on Senator Ringo's question, obviously the fact is that in dependency cases or termination of parental rights cases that telephone testimony was to be used, but is it just automatic to assume that guardianship cases or other types of forms would also accept telephone testimony? And I understand what your answer was, and it's arguable the court can deny it, but is that a major transition or change in practice?
If I understand your question, Senator, no, it's not a major change. This actually continues what's been done for years.
Well, I thought you said that this expands it. So you said this is restricted to two issues, and now this expands it and opens it up to allow other kinds of proceedings.
There was an argument. There could have been an argument under the old language that it would have applied only to a jurisdictional hearing and a termination hearing itself. I don't think that argument was ever made that I know of in court, although I heard it discussed outside of court. So I don't really think it's an expansion.
Well, okay, so now what you're telling me is that it said one thing, they were doing something else. The legislature screwed up and deleted it, thinking it was a civil proceeding. Now we're going to go back and reauthorize what was previously being done.
I'm sorry, Senator. I did not mean to imply that the legislature screwed up by not understanding the difference. The people who brought it to the legislature, I'm sure
the legislative council drafted it. That's but. You know, I wanted to try to take some meat off of those folks.
My old daddy used to say, "When you're in the hole, stop digging, Timothy."
Yeah.
I'm not sure. Could the senator restate his question, please? Because I'm flustered.
Tim, you said earlier that there were two allowances under the previous statute prior to the 2001 session. Those were termination of parental rights and dependency.
Correct.
And then you said something about this is better because, and you mentioned guardianship and a few other kinds of proceedings. So I assumed by that this was an expansion of the use of telephonic testimony. That's why I asked the question as to whether or not those persons who might practice in areas of guardianship or some other proceeding that might exist under this statute might disagree with your premise that it's okay to use telephone testimony. I know it comes under, again, your answer, Senator Ringo,
right,
that the court can deny it.
But the guardianship statute, ORS 125, that is a civil proceeding. Well, the guardianship that I was talking about is a guardianship under the juvenile code, ORS 419B. There are two types of guardianship under the juvenile code that are separate from the guardianship under the probate code, which is ORS 125. The ORS 125 proceedings, those guardianship proceedings, were not impacted by the change that was made in the last legislative session, only any action under the juvenile code. And when I said it was possibly an expansion, what I meant was that I had heard practitioners in the past say, sure, you can have telephone testimony in a dependency case, but can you really in a guardianship case, because it's not mentioned in the statute specifically? People who practice in juvenile court often get together and have esoteric conversations about things that don't ever get argued in court. But as I always remind people when we're looking at the juvenile code, someday they could get mentioned in court, and if we don't deal with them, they can be a problem.
Okay, so I'm going to delete the word in my notes that said expands and put the word in clarifies.
Oh, thank you, Senator. Thank you.
Because I think I understand where you're going here without belaboring the point. All right. Thank you. Any other questions or anybody want to harass Mr. Travis?
Yeah.
Okay. We'll do a little work session on Senate Bill 667.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Walker.
I'll move Senate Bill 67 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation, and I'm not sure I want to put it on the consent calendar because there was some confusion about it.
Okay. Senator Walker moves that Senate Bill 67 be adopted on the Senate floor for the do-pass recommendation and not part of the consent calendar. Which is fine with me. Is there any discussion? Any objection? There's no objection. Passes. And Senator Starr, would you like to give a convention for this? And let me see. Who's on my hit parade now? Lisa Kay, Senate Bill 6, Senate Bill 70. Lisa Kay, public hearing. Hello.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. I am Lisa Kay. I'm an attorney at the Juvenile Rights Project. I'm here to talk to you today about Senate Bill 70. I was the chair of the sub-work group on the guardianship bill that you have before you. I'm going to provide a brief overview of the bill and then a brief section-by-section analysis and then answer any questions.
Okay.
This bill creates what I'm calling a general guardianship, and the term general doesn't mean anything, but just for the purposes of my testimony, so I can distinguish it from other types of guardianships that I'm going to be referring to, I'm calling it a general guardianship.
Okay, it's a general guardianship, but not really a general guardianship. It's kind of a placeholder term here.
Exactly.
Okay.
The bill creates as what I'm calling a general guardianship for children who are within the jurisdiction of the court. It specifies the standards and procedures to establish, modify, review, and vacate that guardianship. This bill also amends current law. Currently in the juvenile code, there is a permanent guardianship which refers the court and practitioners to the probate code to follow the probate code procedures for establishing a guardianship. Since this bill creates such procedures, it amends the permanent guardianship statute to follow the same procedures as needed for this guardianship. Why this is needed is because when ASFA was created, the Adoption Assistance and Adoption Safe Families Act of 1997, it's a federal law, and it envisions multiple permanent plans to be enacted for children depending on each individual child's needs. For some children, it's returning home to parents. For some children, it's adoption. For other children, it's guardianship. In the current juvenile code, there are two types of guardianships. There's a permanent guardianship, which is used for the few children whose circumstances are such that their parents are unfit by termination of parental rights standards, but adoption is not an appropriate plan for them. The juvenile code also contains a statute for temporary guardianships, and those agencies or individuals can be granted temporary guardian, can be granted the duties and authority of a temporary guardian when they are appointed as a temporary custodian.
Senator Ringo.
When you say temporary guardianship, does that include a guardian ad litem?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, it does not.
So a guardian ad litem, that falls out of this whole discussion?
Correct. This bill has nothing to do with guardian ad litems.
Thank you.
The report talks in detail about how the temporary guardianship procedures and how the probate guardianship procedures fall short of serving children in juvenile court. I won't go into those details today because they are explained in the report. As you'll see also in the report, there was several individuals who participated in the work group from a varying number of agencies. CASA participated, juvenile court, the juvenile department, juvenile court judges, the state court administrator's office, and DHS. I'm able to report on behalf of DHS that they support the bill and there is no fiscal impact to the Department of Human Services for this bill. Moving on to the brief section-by-section analysis of the bill, I'm going to skip over Section 2 for right now and move right on to Section 3. Section 3 states who may file a guardianship petition or guardianship motion. It talks about the requirement of a home study. A home study must be submitted for the proposed guardian if the child is in the legal custody of the Department of Human Services. The Department of Human Services must submit that report. The court can order the proposed guardian to submit a report at the proposed guardian's expense if the child is not in the Department of Human Services custody. It talks also about the grounds for granting a guardianship and the burden of proof for guardianships. Section 4 details what must be in the order for granting the guardianship and also specifies that the court must issue letters of guardianship. And in Section 4, subsection 3 talks about there's a mandate for guardians to submit an annual report to the juvenile court. When the juvenile court receives the report, the court must review the report and cause it to become part of the juvenile court file.
The juvenile court. Can I go back to section, page one again, section
sure.
three. This kind of stands out. Maybe you can explain. On line 24 and 25, there's a use of a term or a phrase, preponderance of competent evidence.
Yes.
The word competent added is new to me. Explain that.
Mr. Chair, we had some discussions during a larger work group about the meaning of the word competent evidence. There are other places in the juvenile code that talk about competent evidence, so it was just copied from there. I don't know if competent necessarily means anything specific.
I always assume that evidence is what it is.
Correct.
And to say competent evidence implies that there is an incompetent evidence or something less than competent, and I'm not sure what that really means.
Well, Mr. Chair, there could be evidence that's irrelevant or, that would be one example,
but
I suppose, of...
The rules of evidence allow irrelevant evidence to not be admitted or to be eliminated from
correct
record. So I just don't know where this term competent evidence comes from or what its history is or why we use it as opposed to just preponderance of the evidence, which has a meaning.
Mr. Chair, where that I'm looking for the specific reference in 419B310, which talks about the hearing on the petition of in a juvenile court action, it refers in that subsection 3 of that section talks about competent evidence.
Well, tell me, what is that? I don't understand what competent. It seems to me that if we say competent evidence, and maybe it does exist in statute, that someone could argue that the evidence is incompetent. That may sound trivial, but it's an argument that opens a door.
Mr. Chair, I don't know exactly where the term competent evidence comes from. In juvenile court...
Tim Travis may have an answer for us here. If you don't mind, I'll throw him up here. Maybe he can help you, or maybe he'll confuse me even more.
Timothy Travis, the Oregon Judicial Department. There are times in juvenile court in which the court may hear and consider information despite the fact that under the evidence code it may not be admissible. And that is in a dispositional situation. The court can hear hearsay evidence about a child's history and prognosis or whatever. During a review hearing, the court may also hear information without reference to its admissibility under the evidence code. But there are times in the juvenile code where it is absolutely necessary that what the court hears is competent in the sense that it meets the standards of the evidence code to come into evidence. And that's the distinction between competent evidence in the juvenile code and information or evidence.
All right. So given that's the case, then why wouldn't we state that as a matter of definition in the rewrite? I mean, you're explaining to me a practice that occurs now that's not, I'm assuming it's not codified in law anywhere.
It is
codified.
Mr. Chair.
Okay, help me understand that.
In 419B 325, it talks specifically about what information the court's allowed to receive despite what it says, the competency or relevancy under the rules of evidence.
Okay, and that's, but is there a definition of competent evidence?
Mr. Senator, in the definition section, 419A, where it has definitions in the juvenile code, there is no term competent evidence that is defined.
Well, why wouldn't we put one in there? If you know what you're talking about, you know what you mean, why wouldn't we put it in there?
I think it's because the idea of competent evidence is used in the juvenile code to distinguish it from this information that comes in a dispositional hearing that is not competent evidence.
Okay. I have no problem with that, but why don't we say that?
Perhaps, Mr. Chair, I can read to you what's allowed to come in despite competency or relevancy.
Right.
And I think when you look at that definition, it helps carve out what's not. And it says, for the purposes of determining proper disposition of the child, testimony, reports, or other material relating to the child's mental, physical, and social history and prognosis may be received by the court without regard to their competency or relevancy under the rules of evidence. So by this definition, which sort of carves out what can be received despite its competency, I think is...
Right, but I guess what I'm trying to say is in terms of statutory construct, why wouldn't we reference back somehow to what we're talking about? If we say competent evidence, then again, by implication, there's an incompetent evidence. The incompetent evidence is what you're explaining to me here, which is something.
And I think, Mr. Senator, the reason that may not have been done in the past is because anywhere in the statute that it says evidence, it's presuming that it's competent.
Right.
And that this is an exception. The juvenile code has exceptions.
I understand. And what I'm suggesting is by saying competent evidence in the statute, there's an implication that there's incompetent evidence. And if you explain to me if there are proceedings in which they do receive information that would not rise to the level of being competent or otherwise admissible. Is that correct? And if that's the case, then why wouldn't we tie it together? What I'm trying to do is help me understand the lineage here of the process and make it work in the statute.
And we actually have an ongoing effort, a bill you're not hearing today, pardon me, which is a law commission bill, which has to do with word usage in the juvenile code. It's Senate Bill 68, which you will be hearing later. And we're having another meeting of that group this Friday. And I'll be glad to bring that up to the group and see if perhaps...
Senate Bill
68. Oh, I'm sorry, 69. I'm sorry.
69.
Excuse me. Senate Bill 69. And I'll bring that up to the group, and we can talk about whether or not the group thinks that that's a good thing to do.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Ms. Kate, and Mr. Travis, when I'm looking at 419B325, it talks about allowing certain reports in without regard to their competency. So what it does is it creates an exception to the rule of evidence. Now, I'm wondering if you go back to this bill in line 25, and remove competent so that you have by the preponderance of evidence, which is a normal term used, what have you lost? because in this other provision you've created an exception which allows certain documents in. So if we took out the word competent on line 25, would that remove the confusion here without doing any damage?
I think, as Ms. Kay said earlier, the term was simply adopted because it's used elsewhere. I think you're right. I think if you remove competent, you don't lose anything, because the exception when, quote-unquote, incompetent evidence can be used, that is narrowly defined by the dispositional statute. And also there's a couple of other places in the code that say you can receive evidence as per that dispositional statute. So if you remove the word competent, you don't lose anything.
Mr. Chairman, as a committee, if I could follow up to what we're saying is, for example, in hearsay, if they're going to allow hearsay in, the statute will specifically state that it's allowed in. And in these other provisions where we add the word competent, which is not typically used in the term preponderance of the evidence, we are being overly cautious and quite possibly creating a trap.
I think that may be right, Mr. Counsel. It is one of those things that was written in the Juvenile Code probably in 1950, and that has been repeated, and that we are gradually over the years rooting out. And so perhaps removing it here would merely speed that process. But as I say, I will talk to the group and see what the group thinks about whether or not we need the term and what we should do.
Mr. Chairman, this committee, one further question. My assumption is, too, one of the general rules of construction is that if the legislature used different terms, it means different things. So we know what preponderance of the evidence means. If we use preponderance of the competent evidence, then it arguably means something different. And then we have to figure out what that is. Once again, getting back to the fact that it causes confusion.
And I would suggest if there's not a lineage back to the statute that allows the other type of evidence, then you do open the door for some crafty lawyer somewhere to make an argument. I don't know what that would be.
Absolutely.
And Mr. Chair, the term competent evidence, as I stated, is already in the code when it's talking about hearings to establish jurisdiction and wardship. And I haven't heard there be an argument made that competent evidence means something new and different that
right.
other than that the rules of evidence
right.
apply.
But I guess what I'm saying is you all seem to know what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, to the average person who might pick up the statutes,
sure.
you know, and try to read it systematically, they're not going to necessarily understand what you're saying.
Okay.
And I'm just trying to say, let's do this, make sure that we, you know, the average person who's diligent enough, who's going to read through this, can figure it out.
Sure.
Sorry for that.
Oh, that's quite all right. I believe I left off at subsection 3 of section 4, which talks about the court's options in reviewing the annual report. The committee wanted to have a tiered system and the ability for the juvenile court to respond to different situations that might present itself. In most cases in which a guardianship is established, the guardianship is established, the guardian submits an annual report, and the child lives happily ever after with the guardian. In a few number of cases, there are problems or circumstances that come up in which the court is required to do additional review, or the court would be concerned about the circumstances of the child. If the court receives a report, the court may conduct a review and ask further questions, basically conduct a review hearing. The court may direct that the local citizen review board conduct a hearing for a more in-depth review, or, subject to the availability of funds, the court may appoint a court visitor and require the court visitor to file a report with the court after examining the circumstances of the child. Section 5 of the bill talks about the standards to modify or vacate guardianships. And Section 6 of the bill amends 419B 365, which is the current what's called the permanent guardianship in the juvenile code. And as I stated earlier, the permanent guardianship currently refers individuals to ORS Chapter 125 to follow the probate procedures. Since there are adequate procedures in this bill, it amends the permanent guardianship statute so these procedures will be followed. So individuals do not have to go outside of the juvenile court to know what they need to do to establish a guardianship. Section 8 of the bill talks about the particulars of what the Citizen Review Board would do if they were to review the case of a guardianship. It also includes the language that this is subject to the availability of funds. The review by the Citizen Review Board must take place within 45 days of receiving a report from the court. Section 9 of the bill talks about that section, which it amends 419A 255. The 419A 255 addresses confidentiality. It creates an exception to confidentiality so that guardians who are appointed in the juvenile court may disclose letters of guardianship when so required to fulfill their duties of a guardian. Section 10 of the bill amends 419B 370. 370 is the statute that allows individuals to be appointed as temporary guardians when they are appointed as a temporary custodian of a child. And this is adds some clarifying language, which the group feels helped establish what the actual intent of this section was. There are some circumstances, because there haven't been these procedures in the juvenile code, where the juvenile court has in some ways expanded the procedures used in 370 to appoint individuals as long-term guardians for children instead of just temporary guardians.
Okay, say that again for me, please.
There are, Mr. Chair, there are circumstances where the court has used 419B 370 to appoint long-term guardians for children instead of just appointing someone as a temporary guardian. The group felt that, you know, in the circumstances when that happened, it was because there weren't adequate procedures in the juvenile code to do that when the appropriate plan was a guardianship for a child versus a permanent guardianship. So now that we have this bill has the procedures, then we can clarify that all 370 was really ever intended to do was to appoint someone as a temporary guardian when they were the temporary custodian of the child. As in subsection 1 of 370, as you'll see, which isn't amended, when the court grants legal custody to the Department of Human Services, it may also grant guardianship of the child to the department.
Okay, I have another question. You mentioned permanent guardianship initially, which doesn't mean anything, but suggested that the permanent guardianship refers back to the probate chapter 1.5, and this is rectifying that. But then you mentioned temporary guardianship, and then you just mentioned long-term guardianship. So help me understand the difference between permanent and long-term.
What a permanent guardianship does is the parent's circumstances must fit. The parent's circumstances or the parent's conditions render them unfit to the point where they meet termination of parental rights. So it's in the juvenile code currently where you file a petition that alleges that their rights could be terminated, but the court makes the findings that the court would make in a termination petition. However, the court also finds that termination is not in the best interest of the child, adoption's not the appropriate plan, so it appoints an individual as a permanent guardian.
Okay.
In a permanent guardianship, what's different is that the parent can never petition the court to vacate the guardianship.
Okay.
In terms of the words I'm using, I'm sorry, I'm sort of mixing them up, long-term guardianships or general guardianships.
Right.
Guardianships, when they're enacted or created, are intended to last for the child throughout the child's minority.
Okay.
So in discussing 370 in trying to distinguish a temporary guardianship, which only lasts so long as someone has temporary custody, versus a guardianship, which is long-term, which is intended to last until the child's 18.
Okay,
and
but
that's
what I want to make clear on the record, I hope I'm following this correctly, is that we only now would have, if this was adopted, a permanent guardianship, to use your term, or which is the long-term guardianship, correct?
No, and Mr. Chair,
or the
maybe I should take back the term long-term guardianship.
Well, okay.
What we will have under this, we will have a temporary guardianship.
Which is Section 10, 419B, 370.
370,
right?
Correct,
okay.
For when individuals are granted rights when they are the legal custodian for the child, the temporary
right.
legal custodian.
This is kind of where we're waiting for parents to get their act together
right.
before termination, et cetera, et cetera.
Correct,
so
correct.
Okay.
We will have what I've also called a general
okay.
guardianship.
General guardianship.
And then we will have a permanent guardianship.
Okay, and the general guardianship is, go back on this bill here again, where's general guardianship?
The general guardianship is most of Senate Bill 70. It's Section 3, Section 4, Section 5.
Okay, so 3, 4, and 5 are general guardianship, correct?
Correct.
However, comma.
The procedures that are established by 3, 4, and 5 are referred to
okay.
in Section 6.
Okay.
For the permanent guardianship, you're going to refer back to these procedures and follow them when you're filing a petition
okay.
for a permanent guardianship.
So 3, 4, and 5 set out just a general process for guardianship
correct.
For juveniles, correct?
Correct.
Okay. So what does 6 do?
6 amends 419B 365. 419B 365 is currently the permanent guardianship statute. So
okay.
when you look at subsection 2, the old subsection 2, which is being deleted, said the juvenile court shall hear the permanent guardianship case and follow the procedures in ORS Chapter 125.
Correct.
So it's amended to say, the new section says Sections 3
okay.
Sub 2 and Sub 7, Sections 4, and except as otherwise provided in Section 6 of this section,
okay.
Section 5, the court will have to follow it. So then practitioners in the court don't have to look at the probate procedures
right.
when establishing
I understand
any guardianship.
I'm trying to understand the construct of the bill here.
Madam. Now I'm totally confused.
Well, I think, and I have to do this because I'm not a lawyer. I'm a cop, you know, so get this lined up. But you have a general process that you're setting out for guardianship for juveniles.
Correct.
Is that correct? And that's 3, 4, and 5. Then when we get to 6, we're talking about a permanent guardianship, which refers you back to 3, 4, and 5, or whatever those chapters are reflected there, which is the general process
correct.
For guardianship. But what I do need to understand is that there is apparently a difference between the permanent guardianship, the one for which the parent cannot petition the
mm-hmm.
court to change, and the long-term one.
Correct.
Is there a long-term one, or did we just go back to Chapter 3, to 370, and that's where we got the...
I wish I could take back the phrase long-term guardianship. I was using that to just distinguish between
okay.
the temporary guardianship and what would be a general guardianship.
Okay.
And when a general guardianship, and again, that's my term, general guardianship.
Right.
Or permanent
but let me
guardianship
walk you through this again
mm-hmm.
and see again if I understand this. You've got a general process for guardianship that's being constructed for juvenile proceedings.
Correct.
Correct. Okay. And then we have a permanent guardianship process for these permanent long-term ones in which the parent cannot petition the court to change.
Correct.
Right? And that's in Section 6, correct?
Yes.
And then we have Section 10, where there's the temporary guardianship, which again refers you back to the construct, I'm assuming. Or
It does not, because
okay.
when you are appointing... when someone has legal custody of a child, temporary legal custody, and you give them the rights and authority of a guardian, you can do so, as this states, when it appears necessary to do so in the interests of a child.
Okay, so that's just a blanket statement. The court
cool.
says, it's in the best interest of the child, you are the guardian. Is that right?
Yes, and that's, Mr. Chair, yes, and if I It's because in the juvenile code, there are 419B 373 talks about the duties and authority of a legal custodian, and then it 419B 376 talks about the duties and authority of a guardian. There are some of the duties and authority of a guardian that you want someone with temporary legal custody of the child to be able to do, such as authorized surgery and whatnot for the child.
Okay.
Well, it's getting better. Mr. Chairman, can I ask, you said earlier that under the general guardianship, which sometimes means long-term guardianship but not quite permanent, under a general guardianship, it's still the intention of the guardianship that it lasts for the duration of the child's minority?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, it is. What's different from a permanent guardianship versus what I'm calling a general guardianship, and you will probably never hear anyone else refer to it as a general guardianship. I just needed to come up with some word to refer to this guardianship because there are three kinds of guardianship.
I'm calling it a process.
Okay, well,
right. So what that guardian, parents can petition the court to terminate and vacate that guardianship.
Oh, I see.
So that's where the distinction is between a permanent guardianship and
a guardianship.
A guardianship. Under the guardianship, which is moving back to the standards in Section 3, subsection 6, talks about the grounds for granting what I'm calling a general guardianship. And that is if the court has approved a plan of guardianship in a permanency hearing, the child cannot safely return to a parent within a reasonable time, adoption is not an appropriate plan for a child, and the proposed guardian is suitable to meet the needs of the child and is willing to accept the duties and authority of a guardian, and guardianship is in the best interest of the child.
Mr. Chairman, how do you determine whether adoption is not appropriate? I mean, how is that determination made?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, it's a determination that's based on the individual needs of a child. There are some children who have a significant relationship with their parent. However, that parent is unable to adequately care for them. That child doesn't want, or it would be emotionally damaging for that child to have new parents in an adoption. So that's one example. So it's a determination that's based on the specific needs of a child.
Okay.
And then the standards for creating a permanent guardianship under 419B 365 are different.
For determining what? Permanent.
Permanent guardianship. In a permanent guardianship, the grounds for granting a permanent guardianship are the same as those for termination of parental rights.
Okay, show me the bill where it says that.
It's in, and that's existing law that I was reading from, 419B 365, mm-hmm. subsection 4, which is also on page 4 of the bill. It's now the new subsection 3.
Section 4, subsection 3.
Correct. So 3 and 4 of Section 6 talk about when the court may grant a permanent guardianship. It says the grounds for granting a permanent guardianship are the same as those for termination of parental rights. The court shall grant a permanent guardianship if it finds by clear and convincing evidence that the grounds in the petition are true, and it is in the best interest of the child that the parent never have physical custody of the child, but that other parental rights and duties should not be terminated. So there are different standards for each of the three guardianships in the juvenile code.
Okay. But am I not understanding this? Is it commingled? All of this language is kind of commingled together?
And, Mr. Chair, where the language is commingled and what's the group decided, instead of rewriting the procedures twice in the code to have them appear under the general guardianship and under the permanent guardianship, that as we do in Section 6 of the bill, we refer individuals back to the procedures to establish the general guardianship. Okay. What we could have done was rewrite the procedures that apply.
Well, why couldn't you have constructed the procedures and then delineated between these different guardianships? I mean, referring back, because you're going to use the same procedure.
Correct.
For both kinds of guardianships, correct?
Correct.
But the way it's constructed, first off, you have to be a lawyer who practices this to know where you're going. But in terms of a systematic construct, it seems to me that having a process in place and then a delineation of which kind of guardianship, a permanent guardianship, which is mentioned in the statute, versus a guardianship that's not permanent, in some systematic order would make more sense.
And, Mr. Chair, Legislative Council did work on how the bill was constructed and thought that that is what they achieved, because Section 3 does talk about that is what Legislative Council was attempting to do in the bill by breaking these up into these particular sections.
Okay. Council, do you understand this?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I read the bill several times and I made several phone calls, and but it was very difficult to go through. I mean, it's a complex area. And the other thing to remember is that there is another guardianship provision in Chapter 125, which may or may not deal with children depending on the circumstances, but also it deals with adults who are disabled. So I think what we're talking about here is a process and procedure that's been going on for a fairly lengthy time, but what's attempt here is to bring more structure to it and bring it more within the dependency code. I take it where you particularly use this, where you have a child that's out of control and in need of services. And you would probably not use it in a situation where the kid's not in that circumstances. For example, if parents were disabled and there was no, the child was otherwise okay, I assume you'd use 125.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Counsel, when a child is within the jurisdiction of the juvenile court, that means there must be some conditions and circumstances which brought that child to the juvenile court. Usually it's abuse and neglect, and in some cases it's the child's beyond the control of the parents. When enacting or establishing a permanent plan for the child, it's based on the child's individual circumstances.
But given all of that, you're going to grant a guardianship of how many types? Two types, right? You have permanent guardianship, and then you've got this temporary guardianship where you're trying to figure out who's on first and what's going on,
correct,
and whether or not you're going to proceed to termination or the parents are going to get their act together, right? So you've got those two kinds.
Correct.
Council mentioned 125. Under what circumstances would a juvenile become a guardian under 125?
Mr. Chair, I think that there are very limited circumstances once this is passed for individuals to have to go to Chapter 125. I think individuals do that now because there aren't adequate procedures.
Okay, I understand that, but assuming this
there is a limited circumstance in which when parents are deceased and a child is within the jurisdiction of the court, the only way for the Department of Human Services to obtain consent the ability to consent to the child's adoption, they must be appointed guardians under 125. I would think that after this is passed, that would probably be one of the only circumstances in which they must go to Chapter 125.
Is there a reason to leave that in 125?
Mr. Chair, that was something that our group discussed briefly. I think it's an issue when you're talking about permanent custody, there would be other sections of the juvenile code that should perhaps be looked at. Our group felt that it was beyond the scope of our work, but certainly we can talk about the juvenile code revision work group about looking at that problem during the interim.
Okay. I actually want you to go back and rewrite it. Because I'm not comfortable with it. And that's because I know you'll need lawyers that practice in this area. You all understand each other pretty well. But I don't think it's constructed very well. I don't think it's easy to read. I don't think it makes any sense currently. And I think I'm reasonably bright, but I can't understand it. But I'm a non-lawyer. But the statutes, in my opinion, are not to be constructed in a way that, you know, the average citizen of reasonable intelligence couldn't understand.
But
and I can't understand it.
Certainly not our intent to create a confusing...
I'm not describing blame. I'm just saying sometimes groups talk to each other a lot. They know what they're talking about, but no one else does. So, Tim, you're going to be my victim here. You're going to be my victim here. Because you're good at writing things systematically.
Well, Timothy Travis, Oregon Judicial Department. I appreciate the compliment, Senator, but I was in on writing this.
What's that?
I was in on writing this.
I know that, but you're good at going back and rewriting. Because you've done it before for me.
Many times, Senator. Many, many times.
Thank you. Do you understand what I'm getting at? I mean, you might walk out of here and think I'm the dumbest guy on the face of the earth, but I just have a sense that the average citizen picking up this code isn't going to be able to read it and understand it.
Mr. Chair, I think that what you would like is for it to be broken down in more sections. So there are...
So when you read it, it makes
all
sense.
The procedures are. Mm-hmm. And I think that we would need to work with, I would need to work with legislative counsel to do this.
Yeah. And why don't you work with Bill, and then we'll go to legislative.
Okay.
Senator, if I can ask, is what the senator's asking for that the procedures that are the same be laid out linearly, and then that the differences between the two remedies be laid out as different dispositions, if you will?
That's correct, and then... if we're going to say 125 is an option under certain circumstances, it would seem to me that that needs to be known somewhere. I mean, if you've got one procedure over here and several procedures here, then to me it's confusing.
That one little piece about 125. I've been in this area of the law for a long time, and I didn't even know that until we sat down to do this, because that's such an esoteric little thing that DHS does in these very weird circumstances. So
well, maybe we apply it only to DHS.
Yeah, and so we'll work on it.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like a little more clarity about the distinction between the permanent and the general and the temporary, and if the general's not... the term, if it's just your term, is confusing to me. So, and then you added long term. So I sort of felt like a merry-go-round at one point. So I'd like more clarification about the differences and labeled as to what they are.
And I've got one other question before I conclude this one. On page 3, line 16 and 17, the last sentence says, a guardian is not liable to third persons for acts of the child solely by reason of being appointed guardian. And my question applies to the Department of Human Resources. And maybe this doesn't apply. Let me know if it does not apply.
It
does not.
This is that's for, Mr. Chair, when individuals are appointed as guardians.
Okay. DHS.
No. This language comes from the probate code. That exact same language is in the probate code for individuals who are appointed as guardians for...
All right. Because I wanted to make sure, because we actually did some things last session to make DHS or OIA liable for certain acts, because they weren't...
Correct.
Notice of tort claim.
Yes.
All right. Counsel.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this may be someone who's read the bill a couple of times, and maybe being a case of ignorance being bliss, but maybe it would help, and Ms. Kay can give some responses, and if we put some definitions together as far as all those particular guardianship provisions are concerned. Is that something that's doable?
Would that clarify the issue?
I think it might help, but I just want somebody to like put it together and put a roadmap here so that it's clearly understood. You read through the chapter, it references, makes clear that this is a process, a procedure used for the two following purposes, or whatever the purpose is. And I know you guys don't like us to come in and rewrite what you wrote, but...
Mr. Chair, we can certainly continue to work on this.
Thank you. Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had one other question about citizen review boards that you referenced in Section 8. Does every county have a local citizen review board, and is it specific to juvenile cases?
And actually, Mr. Travis could answer any particulars about the citizen review board since that's his camp, but I believe that, yes, they do have them in every county, and they are, it is something that was created for reviewing juvenile cases.
Timothy Travis, Oregon Judicial Department. The Citizen Review Board is a part of the Oregon Judicial Department. It is a group of local citizens which are appointed by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court in a program administered through the Oregon Judicial Department.
Is that CASA?
No, it is not CASA. CASA is a part of the Oregon Commission on Children and Families. CASAs operate as, quote-unquote, guardians ad litem in juvenile court cases. This is a group of citizens that actually hears the situation as it's going on. They have regular reviews. They hear from the caseworker. They hear from the family. It very much can replace court review of dependency cases, and the court controls whether or not the Citizen Review Board hears the case or the court hears the case. It's a requirement under Title 4E of the Social Security Act for getting the federal money to support foster care in Oregon that these review boards exist and that they review the cases on a periodic basis if the court is not reviewing them. And they do exist in every county, and there's a training program. Nancy Miller, who you frequently hear from, is the director of the Citizen Review Board as well as the division director in the OJD.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification.
All right. Before I conclude this particular, Council, explain the dash.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you have before you the dash 1 amendments, and these amendments are a result of a discussion I had with Ms. Kay. If you look at Section 2, it says, unless the juvenile court orders otherwise, comma, the procedures in this chapter for establishing guardianships are the sole means for which a person may seek to establish guardianship of a child. Well, unless the qualifier, unless the juvenile court orders otherwise, really makes this whole process and procedure more in the nature of a wish than a command, in the sense that, at least broadly read, it could give any juvenile court the ability to follow a different procedure. And I don't think, when I talked to Ms. Kay, that was the intent of the drafters. It was intended that in some circumstances that maybe Chapter 125 could apply. And after discussing the issue and considering the confusion between the two chapters, Ms. Kay thought, and I agreed with her, that this section should be taken out.
Okay. Any final comments?
No, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you. And I apologize for my inability to understand this or make sense in my mind.
No, I'm sure I've been out ill the last 2 days, so I'm sure that it's
not at my best. How, do you feel like going to 71?
Yes.
Okay.
Well,
we for punishment. Okay. Here it is. Going to go 71.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill or Senate Bill 71 is designed to do a very limited thing, which is add service by mail to the approved service when you're serving parties in juvenile court matters. Currently, there are in 419B. 821 talks about service that's permitted without that parties can do this service without getting a court order. That includes personal service, substituted service by leaving a copy of the summons and petition at a person's dwelling, or office service. alternative service is allowed after the court approves such. One example of alternative service is service by publication. There is a Supreme Court case, Lake Oswego v. Steinkamp, which authorizes service by mail when the when a return receipt is signed by the individual it's addressed to. So in Section 1 of the bill, service by mail is added, and then in Section 2, Subsection 4, that includes the details of when service by mail would be adequate service. And as it says in here, service by mail is not complete unless the person signs the receipt.
And this would be service for pendency proceedings, and service to who?
It would be service to parents, and there are some circumstances when children over 12 must be served with a copy of the summons and the petition. So it's service for dependency proceedings and service for termination proceedings. And then when you're serving, again, a permanent guardianship petition, you would use these proceedings as well. There's
in the court in this Lake Oswego versus Steinkamp, is that right? Did I hear that correct? Okay. They said that it's okay to do the mail service as long as the return receipt request was signed by.
Correct. And that is not a juvenile court case. It was in the Oregon rules of civil procedure have approved service by mail for some time. When last session, House Bill 2611 put all of the procedures in the juvenile code. And for some reason, the service by mail was not included in the approved service. But it's been part of the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure.
Okay. Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, I'm a little confused, Ms. Kay. In sub 4 on page 2, lines 9 through 14, you state that a copy has to be mailed by first class mail, and the same thing, mail, return, receipt, or register, and that service is not complete until it's signed. So I'm wondering, why the heck are we even sending it first-class mail when the service isn't complete till it's signed and returned anyway?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, this is language that's in the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure.
Okay.
And I think this is almost word for word. And what that is designed to do is when you're serving people, you want to notify them of an action. So you mail it first-class mail without a return receipt, because sometimes it's individuals receive those when they would not receive something by if they had to sign for it. Mm-hmm. So you mail it that way, and then you also mail it certified. So you need a receipt that shows they actually received it, and it's only, of course, if they actually sign for it that it's approved. But again, this is the structure that's used in the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure.
Senator Burdick and Senator Rangel, yeah. Here.
Senator Walker asked
a question. Oh, I did. Well, I actually had a follow-up question to that, because people can refuse to sign.
Correct.
So service is still not complete if they refuse to sign. So how do you proceed?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, that's absolutely correct. When serving parents, especially when you're serving parents in a termination of parental rights case, they may know what's coming in the mail and they may wish to avoid service. There are many options that are provided. Certainly, I think it's everyone's preference to serve people personally. I think that a lot of times it's easier to serve, when you're talking about parents in a termination of parental rights case, I think it's sometimes easier to serve them personally when they appear for visits or when they appear at court hearings. If someone's going to avoid service, and you simply can't locate that individual, then you would need to move on to the alternative service provisions in the code, which would include things like publication.
And a process server and
correct
local sheriff, that sort of thing.
Correct. Okay. That's why you need different options. One place where this would be, I think, very useful is that sometimes parents reside outside of the state of Oregon, and sometimes it can be very, very costly to need to serve them personally when they're out of state.
Okay, that answers my questions. Thank you.
Okay, I'm not sure how she answered your question, because the issue of it not being complete by if they refuse.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. If they refuse to sign it,
right,
then it's not complete service, and then you need to use some other form of service.
Okay, I'm sorry. Forgive me.
I don't really understand where you're coming from on this. You know, the purpose of personal service is to really give maximum guarantee that the potential defendant did receive a copy. You know, in a civil action, we require personal service, and you can only do alternate service if you go through a series of hoops, you know, mail it, somebody at the household, et cetera, et cetera. But certainly the first choice is personal service.
I was going to say, Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, I would agree that personal service is, as the report drafted by Ted Meese of the Attorney General's Office states that personal service is certainly the...
That gives the maximum guarantee that
correct.
The person's notified. Right?
I would say correct.
But this would allow service by mail where nobody even attempts personal service, true?
That is correct.
And it just seems to me that you lose some certainty that you've actually made service. I mean, I've sent plenty of certified letters to people, and the signature that I get back is a scribble. I don't know the name of the person that actually picked up that envelope. There's no way of knowing that if the person's signature is illegible, like mine is, for example. Mm-hmm. So how would the person know if service was made?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, I think then if there's a question that service by mail is adequate, either there is going to be a hearing and someone that has another signature of the parent would submit that, or the individuals are going to need to perform some other kind of service.
If it's good to do this to take away somebody's parental rights, for example, why don't we just do this for civil lawsuits?
Well, didn't you say that was allowable under the rules of civil procedure?
Mr. Menace, that was what my understanding was in the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure.
I mean, it's a very last... First, it's personal service. And if the person's not home, then you can do somebody at their household above the age of 12, I believe, as long as you send a follow-up letter. Or you can send it to... You can serve as somebody's place of employment, as long as you send a follow-up letter. And if you can't do any of those, then you can go to the court, and you can get permission to, say, put in the newspaper... Or
that's the alternate.
And I don't know, that Lake Oswego versus Steinkamp case, that doesn't say that, I mean, I don't know what that case says, but it doesn't say that you can do service by mail as a preferred means, does it?
My understanding, again, this is from the report submitted by Ted Meese, is that service by certified mail is constitutionally adequate so long as return receipt is signed by the individual that it's obtained from.
Oh.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, currently... substitute service is authorized, as is office service, and I think
that.
The group felt that service by mail that's signed by the individual it's addressed to is just as good as some of these other ones. And there's not currently in the law a requirement that personal service be tried first.
Okay. I mean, Mr. Chair, I filed a lot of lawsuits. It costs $25 in general in the state of Oregon to have a sheriff serve. It's not that much. Out of state, yes, it is a little more. I mean, sometimes $50, $100. But for me, the added protection of having personal service is worth it when you're talking about somebody's parental rights. And if we're making a change for, if you really want to make a change in the way lawsuits are started, I don't know why that wouldn't apply in civil cases as well.
Senator, I tend to agree with you, and I'm trying to make sure I understand what was said originally. Your original presentation led me to believe that under the rules of civil procedure, this process exists, and we're just making it clear in the juvenile proceedings that it would be consistent with ORCP, but then at the Rigo, you're asserting that...
Well, I don't know what the Lake Oswego versus Steinkamp case says, but I'm willing to bet you it says that somebody had to go to the court to get permission to seek to do it by mail, and maybe I shouldn't even be guessing. But I can tell you that nobody I know starts a lawsuit right now by sending a letter. I guarantee you that.
There's probably an assumption that you may run into some trouble on the service question when you try to get to the core of your suit. Senator Burdick.
Chairman, thank you. It says that it's delivered when the person signs it. And now, what is the remedy if someone else signs it and it kind of slips through the cracks and the person does not get their due process because they in fact never received it? What is the remedy if another person signs it, you know, the scrawl example that Senator Ringo gave? Is there any remedy available?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, if someone else signed it and the court approved that signature for some reason, I don't know if they would, there are circumstances when you can proceed in someone's absence. Certainly if the court proceeds in someone's absence and would say terminate their parental rights, but they never actually received notice, then certainly that would be grounds for setting aside the judgment. You must have adequate service in order to proceed.
How would they go about proving that? I mean, is there a process for challenging the receipt? I mean, I don't see any procedure here for filing a challenge if they dispute that they signed it.
What's that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, I think that the burden on showing that the person who it was addressed to signed for it is on the person doing the service. So if that person is unable to prove that the person who signed it was the person it was addressed to, then they would not be able to proceed. There are procedures in the code that talk about when someone can petition to modify or set aside orders. It would be hard for me to think of a circumstance if there was truly a scrawl on a return receipt and you couldn't identify who signed it, then I would think that would be inadequate service.
I started out being comfortable with this, and I'm getting less comfortable because of...
Well, I've got a strange feeling that the rules of civil procedure probably are consistent with this language, but I think Senator Ringo is probably a little concerned that that's not the practice for most attorneys in civil law. They would ordinarily go to the personal service first because it's more sure and something more defensible if that issue arises.
Mr. Chair, I would just like the opportunity to go over this closer with counsel and with Ms. Kay. There's a provision in here that says service by mail, but I think in practice that's always used as a backup means when you can't do personal service. And maybe that's the way this bill is written, but I don't want there to be a suggestion that people are going to be doing service by mail as the first means of serving someone's employee. So I that's what I would suggest.
I think that's actually a very good point, because for the purpose of expediency, you know, dependency, of course, they just may follow the mail procedure because it's a little bit more difficult and maybe more costly to do the personal service.
Right. And Mr. Chair, I'm sorry.
Yes, Senator Burdick.
Well, one of the things I'm very comfortable with is regardless of what process it is, backing it up with just a plain first-class mail, mm-hmm. you know, that's not a binding thing, but I'm very comfortable with that on the grounds that, you know, it gets there quicker and it's kind of a backup.
Mm-hmm. And, Mr. Chair,
mm-hmm.
I do know that Ted Meese, who worked on this bill and drafted the report, did want to be here today and could not because he is working in Eastern Oregon today, so I think taking some time and talking with him would also be it.
Okay.
Well, I think it's probably prudent to put a little bit more time into this. And I had one maybe silly question, but if we authorize service by mail, are there rules with respect to where you mail it? I mean, is it the last known address? Is it the place of business? Is it, what is it? I mean, I could put it, you know, care of whomever. It's
in auto cases, you have to at least include the last known address given the DMV.
Okay.
Obviously, you wouldn't have that here.
Yeah. So, I mean, again, it's not that people are going to skirt the law or outer edges of the envelope, but.
Right.
No.
Sure. And, Mr. Chair, unless you had an address where you knew where they were residing, you're probably not going to.
Well, in some of these cases, you probably have to say, I'm living with my cousin Billy Bob, and here's my new address. And, you know, it may or may not be so.
You're right, Mr. Chair. And I think that's very true. A lot of times when parents of children in dependency or termination proceedings actually don't have a residence, which is why I think personal service is sometimes easier, only better.
Great. Well, we have a few minutes left to do Senate Bill 72, and that is someone else's responsibility. What is this bill? At least you get to rest, Ms. Kay. All right. We'll close the public hearing on 71. Open a public hearing on Senate 72. Linda Gus, you sound like you're coming over a cold tour.
I am. Ms. Kay and I may have the same bug, unfortunately.
Okay.
My name is Linda Gus. I'm an assistant attorney general with the Oregon Department of Justice. I work in the General Counsel Division in the Human Services section. My primary responsibility is to advise the Department of Human Services Child Welfare Program. I participate on the Oregon Law Commission at the request of and for the purpose of advising the Department of Human Services and specifically the Child Welfare Program. I'm here today to present Senate Bill 72. I have a report that I've prepared as well as copies of Senate Bill 72-1 amendments, which are very small.
Okay.
Senate Bill 72 proposes three different things. First, it is intended to resolve inconsistencies between two different statutes, a statute found in the Juvenile Code 419B116, which governs intervention, the process of becoming a party to a juvenile court proceeding, and ORS 109119, which governs intervention in other types of proceedings regarding children, such as domestic relations cases, filiation actions, guardianships. The second purpose of this bill is to establish and clarify standards and procedures for granting intervention in juvenile court cases, as well as for recognizing persons with rights of limited participation in those proceedings. Lastly, the bill is intended to reorganize somewhat statutes regarding intervention and rights of limited participation so that they're all found in one section instead of being found in two different sections as they are right now. It was the intent to make this a little more user-friendly for people who are interested in becoming participants in juvenile court proceedings. Just quickly walking through the bill, there are five sections. Section 1 amends 419B875, which is in the juvenile code. 419B875 is the statute which describes the parties to juvenile court proceedings, so parents, guardians, court-appointed special advocates, folks like that are described as parties, and that statute also describes the rights that those parties have. A leftover from several years ago is a provision in that section that describes how people can become recognized as persons with rights of limited participation. So instead of just simply describing who the parties are, that section actually includes information about you can file a motion and actually be recognized. So this bill deletes the sections regarding how you become a person with rights of limited participation. Those provisions are moved to another section of the code, which is reflected in another section of this bill. Section 2 amends the exact same statute. That's because there is this statute has amendments that become effective October 1 of 03, and so the identical amendments are contained in sections 1 and section 2 for the same statutes. What I understand is that section 2, the language in section 2, what's different from section 1 is that court-appointed counsel is changed to appointed counsel, which I believe was done throughout the statutes. Section 3 amends 419B116. 419B116 is a new provision that was added during the last session, and 419B116 is intended to be the exclusive means by which people intervene in juvenile court proceedings. This section legislative session describes what a caregiver relationship is and how people can become parties to juvenile court cases. And in this bill, all of the provisions regarding persons seeking to have rights of limited participation are moved into 419B116. They are moved, but they are also modified. They are modified to include some specific procedures, including how people file motions, how people object, how hearings are conducted, and what proof is required. In the old statutes, persons who wanted to have rights of limited participation had to file an affidavit, and that was essentially all that was said about what they had to do. There was no procedure established for having a hearing or having folks object or having the person seeking those rights actually prove what they have alleged in their affidavit. Section 4 amends ORS 109-119, which, as I mentioned in my earlier, is the statute that governs how people can become parties or intervene in other types of procedures. Last session, there was inadvertently a reference left in 109-119 to the juvenile code, and what that meant is that people seeking to intervene could actually look at 109-119, and it appeared that they could intervene in juvenile court cases by using the procedures established in 109-119. That conflicts directly with 419B116, which established that 419B116 was the exclusive means to intervene in juvenile court cases. So you had two statutes that really were saying opposite things. And then Section 5 is similar to what I've already described. It amends the same thing that Section 4 amends, but they are statutes that become effective October 1 of 2003. So the substantive sections really under consideration would be Sections 1, 3, and 4. The work group that worked on this bill included representatives from the Department of Justice, from the Juvenile Rights Project, and from the Department of Human Services. Members of that group that participated occasionally included district attorneys and other private defense attorneys. As mentioned in my report, the bill was presented to the Juvenile Code Revision Work Group in both September and October, and that work group expressed support for the changes proposed by this bill.
All right. Thank you. Any questions?
This one makes sense.
All right. You're the only person signed up to testify, so if there are any questions. I want to take a little bit more time and read it more fully myself. But it actually seems to make sense so far. The more I read it, I like it. Listen, I appreciate everyone's willingness to sit here and listen to me and put up with this. Hopefully we're doing good things. Anybody else want to say anything to the committee? Tim, got anything to say? No? All right. Senator Starr?
There's an amendment to this bill.
Oh, there is an amendment to the bill. Maybe we should explain that. Does anybody know? I'm sorry.
The cold medicine was kicked in. There is an amendment to the bill. I'm sorry. When it was presented to the Oregon Law Commission, one of the commissioners had some questions regarding two provisions. They're both found on page 5, one on line 17 and one on line 33, where there's a reference to rights that a person might seek. And the commissioner was concerned that the term rights was too general or too generic, and that really it was important to specify that what we were talking about were rights of limited participation. So the 72-1 amendments make two changes to the bill to take care of that problem.
Yeah. Just for clarity's sake.
Yes.
Come back to my original thing in the other bill. Okay. Good. Thank you very much. No other business before the committee.